I was invited to preach about the diaconate today, this being the last Sunday of Epiphany, Transfiguration Sunday. Okay, well, the truth is, had I been invited to St. Francis on a different Sunday, I would have also found a reason why it was the perfect Sunday to preach on the diaconate. Pentecost, for example, with its theme of reaching out to all people of different languages and cultures, fits the diaconate very well. Yes, I confess that my enthusiasm for the diaconate and the ministry of deacons is so great that I can find an excuse to talk about deacons on any occasion and with reference to any Bible passage. But with that confession out of the way, I do find a real connection between the gospel accounts of the transfiguration of Jesus and the work of deacons. And actually, the version of the transfiguration story that we heard this morning from the Gospel of Luke is particularly helpful in illustrating that connection. Each gospel account of the transfiguration of Jesus begins the same way. Jesus took three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, up on a mountaintop to pray with him. Going apart to pray was not unusual. Jesus did that regularly, often taking a few of his followers. But this time, while they were praying together on the mountain, something amazing happened. Jesus' face began to glow, and his clothes became dazzling white. Although I wonder, do you think maybe Jesus always looked that way, and what changed was the disciples' vision? Perhaps on the mountaintop, the disciples were gifted with a mystical moment in which they could see Jesus in his true glory. At any event, once they saw Jesus in his transformed state with his clothes dazzling white, then the disciples saw two prophets from the Old Testament, Moses and Elijah, talking to Jesus. They appeared in glory and were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. And then, as if these unexpected events were not enough, a cloud covered the mountain, and the disciples heard a voice coming from the cloud proclaiming, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." And after that, the vision ended. Whatever doubts Peter, James, and John may have had before about who they were following, their vision on the mountaintop would have laid those doubts to rest. What an experience. Maybe like me, you hear the story of the transfiguration of Jesus and you think, "Oh, if only I could have been there too." Such graced moments, when we actually experience God in a tangible, direct way, are emotionally overwhelming and spiritually grounding. They're wonderful. They're also very rare. As my friend Gary says, mystical visions cannot be prefabricated or pre-ordered. Not surprisingly, Peter, James, and John wanted to stay on the mountaintop. They longed to remain immersed in the mystical experience. Peter, always trying to be helpful, suggests that he could build huts for Jesus, Elijah, and Moses. But Jesus knows they must come down off the mountain. Like the disciples, we wish that those luminous moments when we feel surrounded by God's presence could last forever, but they can't. And this is why I particularly appreciate the version of the transfiguration of Jesus that we heard this morning from the Gospel of Luke. It makes the connection clear between the mystical vision on the mountaintop and the nitty-gritty of life that comes next. The gospel account continues. On the next day, when they had come down from the mountain, a great crowd met him. People were desperate to get close to Jesus because they were suffering. Jesus offered them healing, not only words of comfort and instruction, but also real, tangible relief from their suffering. In this instance, a father begs for healing for his only son. He says that a spirit throws him to the ground. The spirit makes his son shriek and foam at the mouth. Modern commentators have suggested that the son may have had epilepsy, and this sounds plausible to me. But I don't want the search for a reasonable-sounding medical interpretation to distract us from the deeper truth. The Gospel of Luke uses this kind of dramatic language about the spirit that mauls the son in order to make it clear that both the father and the son are caught up in a desperate and frightening situation to which they have no solution. And I think you could say that that's the situation we're all in without God. The father couldn't help his suffering son. And the spirit was apparently also too powerful for Jesus' disciples. But Jesus tells the father, "Bring your son here." While he was coming, the demon dashed him to the ground in convulsions, but Jesus rebuked the unclean spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And all were astounded at the greatness of God. Let's pause just a moment for that last line that we heard from the gospel. And all were astounded at the greatness of God. This morning's reading from the Gospel of Luke makes it clear that the mystical vision on the mountaintop and the healing of a boy possessed by a spirit both reveal the greatness and glory of God. My friend Gary Cummins, whom I mentioned earlier, recently published a book entitled If Only We Could See. In this book, Gary explores connections and similarities between mystics and social activists. He argues that both mystical vision and social activism are important and dangerous because they challenge the status quo. But he also reminds us there is no glory of the mystic nor glory of the social activist, but only the glory of God. And so finally, this brings me to the ministry of deacons. While I don't want to overdraw the distinction, you could say that the ministry of priests is to lead us up to the mountaintop to pray and to listen for the voice of God. And the ministry of deacons is to lead us down from the mountaintop into the crowds where we encounter God in human suffering and healing. When a deacon is ordained, the bishop gives us two important instructions. First, in the name of Jesus Christ, you are to serve all people, particularly the poor, the weak, the sick, and the lonely. And then you are to interpret to the church the needs, concerns, and hopes of the world. As deacons, we're called to take the church out into the hurting world and then to bring news of the needs of the world back into the church. This means that deacons constantly walk with one foot inside the church and one foot outside the church. And I can assure you that is not a comfortable way of walking. Today we have about 50 deacons serving in the Diocese of Los Angeles, and that means that there are probably at least 50 different ways of describing the ministry of deacons. The easiest part of diaconal ministry to describe is actually what you see on Sunday mornings. The liturgical roles of deacons are pretty clearly laid out in the Book of Common Prayer. When a deacon is present, he or she should be the one to read the gospel, bid the confession, set the altar for the Eucharist, clean up the altar after the Eucharist, and do the dismissal. And ask me afterwards if you want to know why I think the dismissal is the most important thing that the deacon does. But the heart of a deacon's ministry is not, I repeat, not what we do on Sunday mornings. It's what we do the other 6 days of the week. A deacon's work in the world can take many forms. Deacons serve in jails, in hospitals, and in schools. Diaconal vocations include helping homeless folks get housed, helping sick people get health care, and helping gang members go straight, to mention just a few examples. But what all deacons have in common, or should have in common, is that they are servant leaders. And both parts of that are important, servant and leader. Every deacon I know is willing, even eager, to provide humble, hands-on service in the most marginalized, most neglected corners of human life. But deacons cannot and should not do this work on our own. Deacons are actually ordained to serve as icons or catalysts for the diaconia of all believers, the ministry that we're all called to. Deacons encourage and help others live fully into their baptismal vows. This is the fifth year that I've been traveling around the diocese preaching and talking about the diaconate. The goal has been partly educational, since many people, even in the church, are still confused about who deacons are and what we do. But even more, the goal has been to raise up deacons. During these 5 years, I've come to understand much better than I did at the beginning that being a deacon is not a call for everyone. The work is hard, the pay is poor to non-existent, and we mostly work at the margins of the church as well as the margins of society. But I can tell you that it has been an unimaginable blessing in my life to serve as a deacon for the last 14 years. And I am convinced that right here, right now, at St. Francis, there are two or three people whom God is calling to join the Sacred Order of Deacons. So listen carefully. God might be calling you.